from the passing pedestrians. Go on. Someone stabbed a hooker down in Shacklewell and cut off two of her fingers as a souvenir. Deliberately cut them off. Pinned her arm down and hacked at them. Jesus. When was this?
10 days ago. 29th of April. She's only just come out of an induced coma.
She survived, said Strike, now taking his eyes entirely off the windows, behind which Whittaker might or might not have been lurking, his attention all Wardle's.
By a fucking miracle, said Wardle.
He stabbed her in the abdomen, punctured her lung, then hacked off her fingers. Miraculously missed major organs. We're pretty sure he thought she was dead. She'd taken him down a gap between two buildings for a blowjob, but they were disturbed. Two students walking down Shacklewell Lane heard her scream and went down the alley to see what was going on. If they'd been 5 minutes later, she'd have been a goner. It took two blood transfusions to keep her alive.
And, said Strike,
what's she saying?
Well, she's drugged up to the eyeballs and can't remember the actual attack. She thinks he was a big, beefy white guy wearing a hat, dark jacket, upturned collar. Couldn't see much of his face, but she thinks he was a northerner.
She does, said Strike, his heart pounding faster than ever.
That's what she said. She's groggy, though. Oh, and he stopped her getting run over. That's the last thing she can remember. Pulled her back off the road when a van was coming.
What a gent, said Strike, exhaling smoke at the starry sky.
Yeah, said Wardle. Well, he wanted his body parts pristine, didn't he?
Any chance of a photo fit?
We're going to get the artist in to see her tomorrow, but I haven't got high hopes.
Strike stood in the darkness, thinking hard. He could tell that Wardle had been shaken by the new attack.
Any news on any of my guys? He asked.
Not yet, said Wardle tersely. Frustrated, Strike chose not to push it. He needed this open line into the investigation.
What about your devotee lead? Strike asked,
turning back to look at the windows of Whittaker's flat, where nothing seemed to have changed.
How's that coming along? I'm trying to get the cybercrime lot after him, but I'm being told they've got bigger fish to fry just now, said Wardle, not without bitterness. Their view is he's just a common old garden pervert.
Strike remembered that this had also been Robin's opinion. There seemed little else to say. He said goodbye to Wardle, then sank back into his niche in the cold wall, smoking and watching Whittaker's curtained windows as before. Strike and Robin met in the office by chance the following morning. Strike, who had just left his flat with a cardboard file of pictures of Mad Dad under his arm, had intended to head straight out without entering the office. But the sight of Robin's blurred form through the frosted glass changed his mind.
Morning.
Hi, said Robin. She was pleased to see him, and even more pleased to see that he was smiling. Their recent communication had been full of an odd constraint. Strike was wearing his best suit, which made him look thinner.
Why are you so smart? She asked. Emergency lawyer's appointment. Mad Dad's wife wants me to show them everything I've got. All the pictures of him lurking outside the school and jumping out at the kids. She called me late last night. He just turned up at the house pissed and threatening. She's gonna throw the book at him, try and get an injunction out.
Does this mean we're stopping surveillance on him?
I doubt it. Mad Dad won't go quietly, said Strike, checking his watch. Anyway, forget that. I've got 10 minutes and I've got news.
He told her about the attempted murder of the prostitute in Shacklewell. When he had finished, Robin looked sober and thoughtful.
He took fingers.
Yeah.
You said, when we were in the Feathers, you said you didn't see how Kelsey could have been his first murder. You said you were sure he'd worked up to
what he did to her.
Strike nodded. Do you know whether the police have looked for any other killings where a bit of the woman was cut off?
Bound to have, said Strike,
hoping he was right and making a mental note to ask Wardle.
Anyway, he said, after this one they will.
And she doesn't think she'd recognize him again.
Like I said, he'd obscured his face.
Big white guy, black jacket.
Did they get any DNA evidence from her? Asked Robin. Simultaneously, both of them thought of what Robin herself had been subjected to in hospital after her attack.
Strike, who had investigated rapes, knew the form.
Robin had a sudden miserable memory of having to pee into a sample bottle, one eye completely closed from where he had punched her, aching all over, her throat swollen from the strangulation, then having to lie down on the examination couch, and the female doctor's gentleness as she parted Robin's knees.
No, said Strike. He didn't. No penetration. Anyway, I'd better get going. You can forget about tailing Mad Dad today. He'll know he's blotted his copybook. I doubt he'll show up at school. If you can keep an eye on Wollaston.
Wait, I mean if you've got time, she added.
Couple more minutes, he said, checking his watch again. What's up? You haven't spotted Lang?
No, she said. But I think, just possibly, we might have a lead on Brockbank.
You're kidding.
It's a strip club off Commercial Road. I've had a look at it on Google Street View. Looks pretty grotty. I called and asked for Noel Brockbank, and a woman said, who? And then, Niall, you mean? And she put her hand over the mouthpiece and had a bit of discussion with another woman about what the new bouncer was called. He's obviously only just arrived. So I described him physically, and she said, yeah, that's Niall.
Of course, said Robin self-deprecatingly. It might not be him at all. It could be a dark man who really is called Niall. But when I described the long jaw, she said immediately, you played your usual blinder, said Strike, checking his watch. Gotta go. Text me the details of this strip club, will you?
I thought I might...
No, I want you to stick to Wollaston close, said Strike. Keep in touch.
As the glass door closed behind him and he clanged away down the metal stairs, she tried to feel pleased that he had said she'd played a blinder. Nevertheless, she had hoped for a chance to do something other than stare pointlessly at the flats of Wollaston Close for hours. She was starting to suspect that Lang was not there, and worse still, that Strike knew it. The visit to the lawyers was brief but productive. The solicitor was delighted with the copious evidence that Strike had laid in front of him, which vividly documented Mad Dad's constant violations of the custody agreements.
Oh, excellent, he beamed,
over an enlarged picture of the youngest son, cowering tearfully behind his nanny, as his father snarled and pointed, almost nose to nose with the defiant woman.
Excellent, excellent.
And then, catching sight of his client's expression, he had hurried to conceal his glee at this vision of her child's distress and offered tea. An hour later, Strike, still in his suit but with his tie now stuffed in his pocket, was following Stephanie into Catford Shopping Centre. This meant passing under a gigantic fiberglass sculpture of a grinning black cat, which sat on top of the girder that spanned the alley leading into the mall. Two stories high from its dangling paw to the tip of its jaunty tail, which pointed skywards, it seemed poised to pounce upon or scoop up shoppers as they passed beneath. Strike had decided to follow Stephanie on a whim, never having tracked her before, and intended to return to keep watch over the flat once he had satisfied himself as to where she was going and whom she might be meeting. She walked, as she almost always did, with her arms wrapped tightly round her torso, as though holding herself together, wearing the familiar grey hoodie on top of a black miniskirt and leggings. The slenderness of her twig-like legs was emphasised by her clumpy trainers. She visited a pharmacy, and Strike watched through the window as she sat huddled in a chair, waiting for a prescription, making eye contact with nobody, staring at her feet. Once she had collected her white paper bag, she left the way she had come, passing back beneath the giant cat with its dangling paw, apparently returning to the flat. However, she walked straight past the Chippy in Catford Broadway, and shortly afterwards took a right at the Afro-Caribbean Food Centre,
and disappeared into a small pub called the Catford Ram, which was built into the rear of the shopping centre. The pub, which appeared to have only one window, had a wood-clad exterior that would have given it the look of a large Victorian kiosk had it not been plastered with signs advertising fast food, Sky Sports, and a Wi-Fi connection. The entire area was paved for pedestrians, but a battered grey transit van had been parked a short distance from the pub entrance, giving Strike useful cover as he lurked, debating his options. No purpose would be served at this juncture by coming face to face with Whittaker, and the pub looked too small to avoid being seen by his ex-stepfather, if that was whom Stephanie was meeting. All he really wanted was a chance to measure Whittaker's current appearance against that of the figure in the beanie hat, and perhaps the man in the camouflage jacket who had been watching the court. Strike leaned up against the van and lit a cigarette. He had just resolved to find a vantage point that was a little further away, so that he might observe whom Stephanie left the pub with, when the rear doors of the van behind which he was lurking suddenly opened. Strike took several hasty steps backwards, as four men clambered out of the back, along with a smoky haze that gave out a powerful, acrid smell of burned plastic, that the ex-SIB man recognized immediately as crack. All four were unkempt, their jeans and t-shirts filthy, their age hard to gauge because each of them was sunken-faced and prematurely wrinkled. The mouths of two of them had collapsed inwards onto gums that had lost teeth. Momentarily taken aback to find the clean-suited stranger at such close quarters, they seemed to understand from his startled expression that he had not known what was happening inside and slammed the van doors. Three of them swaggered off towards the pub, but the fourth man did not leave. He was staring at Strike, and Strike was staring right back at him. It was Whittaker. He was bigger than Strike remembered. Although he had known that Whittaker was almost as tall as he was, he had forgotten the scale of him, the breadth of his shoulders, the heft of the bones beneath his heavily tattooed skin. His thin t-shirt, emblazoned with the logo of the band Slayer, which was both militaristic and occult, blew back against him as they stood facing each other, revealing the outline of ribs. His yellow face looked freeze-dried like an old apple, the flesh wasted, the skin shrunken against the bone, with cavities beneath the high cheekbones. His matted hair was thinning at the temples. It hung in rat's tails around his stretched earlobes, each of which was adorned with a silver flesh tunnel. There they stood, Strike in his Italian suit, abnormally well-groomed, and Whittaker, stinking of crack fumes, his heretic priest's golden eyes now set beneath wrinkled, sagging lids. Strike could not have said how long they stared at each other, but a stream of perfectly coherent thoughts passed through his mind while they did. If Whittaker were the killer, he might be panicked, but not too surprised to see Strike. If he were not the killer, his shock at finding Strike right outside his van ought to be extreme. Yet Whittaker had never behaved like other people. He always liked to appear unshockable and omniscient. Then Whittaker reacted, and Strike felt at once that it would have been unreasonable to expect him to do anything other than what he did. Whittaker grinned, revealing blackened teeth, and instantly the hatred of 20 years ago rose in Strike, and he yearned to put his fist through Whittaker's face.
"Looky, look," said Whittaker quietly. "It's Sergeant Sherlock fucking Holmes."
He turned his head, and Strike saw scalp shining through the thinning roots, and took some pleasure in the fact that Whittaker was going bald. He was a vain fucker. He wouldn't like that.
"Banjo!"
shouted Whittaker at the last of his three companions, who had only just reached the pub.
"Bring her out here!"
His smile remained insolent, although the mad eyes flickered from the van to Strike and back to the pub. His filthy fingers were flexing. For all his assumed insouciance, he was edgy. Why didn't he ask why Strike was there? Or did he already know? The friend called Banjo reappeared, dragging Stephanie out of the pub by her thin wrist. In her free hand, she was still clutching the pharmacist's white paper bag. It looked glaringly pristine against her and Banjo's cheap and dirty clothes. A gold necklace bounced around her neck.
"Why you?
What?" she whimpered, uncomprehending. Banjo deposited her beside Whittaker.
"Go get us a pint,"
Whittaker instructed Banjo, who shuffled obediently away. Whittaker slid a hand around the back of Stephanie's thin neck, and she looked up at him with the slavish adoration of a girl who, like Leda before her, saw in Whittaker wonderful things that were totally invisible to Strike. Then Whittaker's fingers gripped her neck until the skin around them went white and began to shake her, not so vigorously as to attract the attention of a passerby, but with sufficient force to change her expression instantly to one of abject fear.
"Know anything about this?"
"About what?"
she stammered. The pills were rattling in her white paper bag.
"Him," said Whittaker quietly. "Him that you're so interested in, you filthy little bitch."
"Get off her," said Strike, speaking for the first time.
"Do I take orders?"
Whittaker asked Strike quietly, his grin wide, his eyes manic. With sudden shocking strength, he seized Stephanie around the neck with both hands and lifted her bodily into the air so that she dropped the white bag on the pavement to try to fight free, her feet scrabbling, her face growing purple. No thought, no reflection. Strike punched Whittaker hard in the gut, and he fell backwards, taking Stephanie with him. Before Strike could do anything to prevent it, he heard the smack of her head on the concrete. Temporarily winded, Whittaker tried to get to his feet, a stream of whispered filth pouring from between his black teeth, while out of the corner of his eye, Strike saw Whittaker's three friends, Banjo at the fore, pushing their way out of the pub. They had seen everything through its one dingy window. One of them was holding a short, rusty blade.
"Do it,"
Strike taunted them, standing his ground and opening his arms wide.
"Bring the cops round your mobile crack den."
The winded Whittaker made a gesture from the ground that had the effect of holding his friends at bay, which was the most common sense Strike had ever known him show. Faces were peering out of the pub window.
"You fucking mother, you motherfucker,"
Whittaker wheezed.
"Yeah, let's talk about mothers," Strike said, jerking Stephanie to her feet.
The blood was pounding in his ears. He itched to punch Whittaker until the yellow face was pulp.
"He killed mine," he told the girl, looking into her hollow eyes.
Her arms were so thin that his hands almost met around them.
"Did you hear that? He's already killed one woman. Maybe more."
Whittaker tried to grab Strike around his knees and bring him down. Strike kicked him off, still holding Stephanie. Whittaker's red handprint stood out on her white neck, as did the imprint of the chain from which hung the outline of a twisted heart.
"Come with me now," Strike told her. "He's a fucking killer. There are women's refuges. Get away from him."
Her eyes were like boreholes into a darkness he had never known. He might have been offering her a unicorn. His proposal was madness, outside the realm of the possible, and incredibly, though Whittaker had squeezed her throat until she could not speak, she wrenched away from Strike as if he were a kidnapper, stumbled over to Whittaker, and crouched protectively over him, the twisted heart swinging. Whittaker allowed Stephanie to help him to his feet and turned to face Strike, rubbing his stomach where the punch had landed, and then, in his manic way, he began cackling like an old woman. Whittaker had won. They both knew it. Stephanie was clinging to him as though he had saved her.
He pushed his filthy fingers deep into the hair at the back of her head and pulled her hard towards him, kissing her, his tongue down her throat. But with his free hand, he gestured to his still-watching friends to get back in the van. Banjo climbed into the driver's seat.
"See ya, mummy's boy,"
Whittaker whispered to Strike, pushing Stephanie in front of him into the back of the van. Before the doors shut on the obscenities and jeers of his male companions, Whittaker looked directly into Strike's eyes and made the familiar throat-slashing gesture in mid-air, grinning. The van moved away. Strike became suddenly aware that a number of people were standing around him, staring, all gazing at him, with the vacant yet startled expressions of an audience when the lights go up unexpectedly. Faces were still pressed up against the pub window. There was nothing left for him to do except memorize the registration number of the battered old van before it turned the corner. As he departed the scene, furious, the onlookers scattered, clearing his way. Chapter 42. I'm living for giving the devil his due. Blue Oyster Cult, burning for you. Fuck-ups happen, Strike told himself. His military career had not been entirely devoid of mishap. You could train as hard as you liked, check every piece of equipment, plan for every contingency, and still some random mischance would screw you. Once in Bosnia, a faulty mobile phone had unexpectedly dumped all its power, triggering a train of mishaps that culminated in a friend of Strike's barely escaping with his life after driving up the wrong street in Mostar. None of this altered the fact that if a subordinate in the SIB had been running surveillance and leaned up against the back of a carelessly parked van without first checking that it was empty, Strike would have had a lot to say about it, and loudly. He had not meant to confront Whittaker, or so he told himself, but a period of sober reflection forced him to admit that his actions told a different story. Frustrated by the long hours watching Whittaker's flat, he had taken few pains to hide himself from the pub windows, and while he could not have known that Whittaker was inside the van, there was a savage retrospective pleasure in knowing that at last he had punched the fucker. God, he had wanted to hurt him. The gloating laugh, the rat's tail hair, the Slayer t-shirt, the acrid smell, the clutching fingers around the thin white neck, the taunting talk of mothers, the feelings that had erupted in Strike at the unexpected sight of Whittaker had been those of his 18-year-old self, eager to fight, careless of consequences. Setting aside the pleasure it had been to hurt Whittaker, the encounter had not produced much meaningful information. Try though he might to effect a retrospective comparison, he could neither identify nor rule out Whittaker as the large figure in the beanie hat on looks alone. While the dark silhouette that Strike had chased through Soho had not had Whittaker's matted locks, long hair can be tied back or tucked into a hat. It had looked burlier than Whittaker, but padded jackets easily add substance. Nor had Whittaker's reaction on finding Strike outside his van given the detective real clues. The more he thought about it, the less he could decide whether he had read triumph in Whittaker's gloating expression, or whether the last gesture, the dirty fingers slashing through the air, had been his usual play-acting, a toothless threat, the infantile retaliation of a man determined at all costs to be the worst, the scariest. In brief, their encounter had revealed that Whittaker remained narcissistic and violent, and given Strike two small pieces of additional information. The first was that Stephanie had aggravated Whittaker by showing curiosity about Strike. And while Strike assumed that this was merely because he had once been Whittaker's stepson, he did not entirely rule out the possibility that it had been triggered by Whittaker mentioning a desire for retribution, or letting slip that he was seeking it. Secondly, Whittaker had managed to make himself some male friends. While he had always had a, to Strike, incomprehensible attraction for certain women, Whittaker had been almost universally disliked and despised by men in the days that Strike had known him. His own gender had tended to deplore his histrionics, the satanic bullshit, his craving to be first in all company and, of course, to resent his strange magnetic pull over females. Now, though, Whittaker seemed to have found a crew of sorts, men who shared drugs with him and allowed him to boss them around. Strike concluded that the one thing he could profitably do in the short term was tell Wardle what had happened and give him the registration number of the van. He did this in the hope that the police would think it worth their while to check for drugs and any other incriminating evidence within the vehicle, or even better, inside that flat over the chippy. Wardle listened to Strike's insistence that he had smelled crack fumes without any form of enthusiasm. Strike was forced to admit, when their call had concluded, that if he were in Wardle's position, he would not have considered his own evidence grounds for a search warrant. The policeman clearly thought that Strike had it in for his ex-stepfather, and no amount of pointing out the Blue Oyster Cult connection between himself and Whittaker seemed likely to change Wardle's mind. When Robin phoned that night with her usual progress report, Strike found relief and solace in telling her what had happened. Although she had news of her own, she was instantly distracted by the announcement that he had come face to face with Whittaker and listened to the whole story in eager silence. "Well, I'm glad you hit him," she said, when Strike had finished castigating himself for allowing the altercation to happen.
"You are?" said Strike, taken aback.
"Of course I am. He was strangling the girl." The moment the words left Robin's mouth, she wished she had not said them. She did not want to give Strike any further reason for remembering the thing that she wished she had never told him.
"As knights errant go, I was on the crap side. She fell over with him and cracked her head on the pavement. What I don't get," he added, after a short pause for reflection, "is her. That was her chance. She could have left. I'd have got her to a refuge. I'd have seen her right. Why the fuck did she go back to him? Why do women do that?"
In the fractional hesitation before Robin replied, Strike realized that a certain personal interpretation could be put on these words. "I suppose," began Robin, and simultaneously Strike said,
"I didn't mean..."
Both stopped.
"Sorry, go on," said Strike.
"I was only going to say that abused people cling to their abusers, don't they? They've been brainwashed to believe there's no alternative."
"I was the bloody alternative, standing there right in front of her." "Any sign of Lang today?" Strike asked.
"No," said Robin. "You know, I really don't think he's there."
"I still think it's worth...
Look, I know who's in every flat except for one of them," said Robin. "People go in and out of all the others. The last one's either unoccupied or someone's lying in there dead because the door never opens. I haven't even seen carers or nurses visit."
"We'll give it another week," said Strike. "It's the only lead we've got for Lang. Listen," he added irritably as she tried to protest, "I'll be in the same position, staking out that strip club."
"Except we know that Brockbank's there," said Robin sharply.
"I'll believe it when I see him," retorted Strike.
They said goodbye a few minutes later in poorly concealed mutual dissatisfaction. All investigations had their slumps and droughts when information and inspiration ran dry. But Strike was finding it difficult to take a philosophical view. Thanks to the unknown sender of the leg, there was no longer any money coming into the business. His last paying client, Mad Dad's wife, no longer needed him. In the hope of persuading a judge that the restraining order was not required, Mad Dad was actually complying with it. The agency could not survive much longer if the twin stenches of failure and perversity continued to emanate from his office. As Strike had foreseen, his name was now multiplying across the internet in connection with the killing and dismemberment of Kelsey Platt, and the gory details were not only obliterating all mention of his previous successes, they were also eclipsing
the simple advertisement of his detective services. Nobody wanted to hire a man so notorious. Nobody liked the idea of a detective so intimately connected with unsolved murder. It was therefore in a mood of determination and slight desperation that Strike set out for the strip club where he hoped to find Noel Brockbank. It turned out to be another converted old pub, which lay on a side street off Commercial Road in Shoreditch. The brick facade was crumbling in parts. Its windows had been blacked out, and crude white silhouettes of naked women painted upon them. The original name, the Saracen, was still picked out in wide golden letters across the peeling black paint over the double doors. The area had a large proportion of Muslim residents. Strike passed them in their hijabs and takiyas, browsing the many cheap clothes shops, all bearing names like International Fashion and Made in Milan, and displaying sad mannequins in synthetic wigs, wearing nylon and polyester. Commercial Road was crammed with Bangladeshi banks, tatty estate agents, English schools, and ramshackle grocers that sold past its prime fruit behind grimy windows. But it had no benches to sit on, not even a low, cold wall. Even though he frequently changed his vantage point, Strike's knee soon began to complain about long stretches spent standing, waiting for nothing, because Brockbank was nowhere to be seen. The man on the door was squat and neckless, and Strike saw nobody enter or leave the place except punters and strippers. The girls came and went, and like their place of employment, they were shabbier and less polished than those who worked at Spearmint Rhino. Some were tattooed or pierced, several were overweight, and one, who looked drunk as she entered the building at 11 in the morning, appeared distinctly grubby, viewed through the window of the kebab shop that lay directly opposite the club. After watching the Saracen for 3 days, Strike, whose hopes had been high, whatever he had said to Robin, reluctantly concluded that either Brockbank had never worked there, or that he had already been sacked. Friday morning arrived before the depressing pattern of no leads changed. As he was lurking in the doorway of an especially dismal clothing store named World Flair, Strike's mobile rang, and Robin spoke in his ear. "Jason's coming to London tomorrow. The leg guy, from the wannabe amputee website." "Great," said Strike, relieved at the mere prospect of interviewing someone. "Where are we meeting him?" "It's them," said Robin, with a definite note of reservation in her voice. "We're meeting Jason and Tempest. She's..."
"Excuse me?" interrupted Strike.
"Tempest?"
"I doubt it's her birth name," said Robin dryly. "She's the woman Kelsey was interacting with online. Black hair and glasses."
"Oh yeah, I remember," repeated Strike, supporting the mobile between jaw and shoulder while he lit a cigarette.
"I've just got off the phone with her. She's a big activist in the trans-abled community, and she's pretty overwhelming. But Jason thinks she's wonderful, and he seems to feel safer with her there."
"Fair enough," said Strike. "So where are we meeting Jason and Tempest?"
"They want to go to Gallery Mess. It's the cafe at the Saatchi Gallery."
"Really?"
Strike seemed to remember that Jason worked in an Asda, and was surprised that his first craving on arriving in London was contemporary art. "Tempest's in a wheelchair," said Robin, "and apparently it's got really good disabled access."
"Okay," said Strike. "What time?"
"1, said Robin. "She, asked whether we'd be paying."
"I suppose we'll have to."
"And listen, Cormoran, would it be all right if I took the morning off?"
"Yeah, of course. Everything okay?"
"Everything's fine. I've just got some wedding stuff to sort out."
"No problem. Hey," he added before she could hang up, "shall we meet up somewhere first before we question him? Agree our interviewing strategy?"
"That'd be great," said Robin. And Strike, touched by her enthusiasm, suggested they meet in a sandwich shop on the King's Road. Chapter 43. Freud, have mercy on my soul. Blue Oyster Cult, still burning. The next day, Strike had been in Pret-a-Manger on the King's Road for 5 minutes when Robin arrived, carrying a white bag over her shoulder. He was as uninformed about female fashion as most male ex-soldiers, but even he recognized the name Jimmy Chu.
"Shoes," he said, pointing, after he had ordered her a coffee.
"Well done," said Robin, grinning. "Shoes, yes, for the wedding," she added, because, after all, they ought to be able to acknowledge that it was happening. A strange taboo had seemed to exist around the subject since she had resumed her engagement. "You're still coming, right?" she added, as they took a table beside the window. Had he ever agreed that he was attending her wedding? Strike wondered. He had been given the reissued invitation, which, like the first, had been a stiff cream card engraved in black, but he could not remember telling her that he would be there. She watched him expectantly for an answer, and he was reminded of Lucy and her attempts to coerce him into attending his nephew's birthday party.
"Yeah," he said, unwillingly.
"Shall I RSVP for you?" Robin asked.
"No," he said. "I'll do it."
He supposed that would entail calling her mother. This, he thought, was how women roped you in. They added you to lists and forced you to confirm and commit. They impressed upon you that if you didn't show up, a plate of hot food would go begging, a gold-backed chair would remain unoccupied, a cardboard place name would sit shamefully upon a table, announcing your rudeness to the world. Offhand, he could think of literally nothing he wanted to do less than watch Robin marry Matthew.
"Do you want... would you like me to invite Ellen?"
Robin asked valiantly, hoping to see his expression become a degree or two less surly.
"No," said Strike without hesitation.
But he read in her offer a kind of plea, and his real fondness for her caused his better nature to reassert itself.
"Let's see the shoes, then."
"You don't want to see the..."
"I asked, didn't I?"
Robin lifted the box out of its bag with a reverence that amused Strike, took off the lid, and unfolded the tissue paper inside. They were high, glittery, champagne-coloured heels.
"Bit rock and roll for a wedding," said Strike. "I thought they'd be, I don't know, flowery."
"You'll hardly see them," she said, stroking one of the stilettos with a forefinger. "They had some platforms, but..." She did not finish the sentence. The truth was that Matthew did not like her too tall. "So, how are we going to handle Jason and Tempest?" she said, pushing the lid back down on the shoes and replacing them in the bag.
"You're going to take the lead," said Strike. "You're the one who's had contact with them. I'll jump in if necessary."
"You realize," said Robin awkwardly, "that Jason's going to ask you about your leg. That he thinks you lied about how you lost it."
"Yeah, I know."
"Okay, I just don't want you to get offended or anything."
"I think I can handle it," said Strike, amused by her look of concern. "I'm not going to hit him, if that's what's worrying you."
"Well, good," said Robin, "because from his pictures you'd probably break him in two." They walked side by side up the King's Road, Strike smoking, to the place where the entrance to the gallery sat a little retired from the road, behind the statue of a bewigged and stockinged Sir Hans Sloane. Passing through an arch in the pale brick wall, they entered a grassy square that might, but for the noise of the busy street behind them, have belonged to a country estate. 19th-century buildings on three sides surrounded the square. Ahead, contained in what might once have been barracks, was Gallery Mess. Strike, who had vaguely imagined a canteen tacked onto the gallery, now realized that he was entering a far more upmarket space, and remembered, with some misgivings, both his overdraft and his agreement to pay for what was almost certainly going to be lunch for four. The room they entered was long and narrow, with a second, wider area visible through arched openings to their left. White tablecloths, suited waiters, high-vaulted ceilings, and contemporary art all over the walls increased Strike's dread
of how much this was going to cost him as they followed the maitre d' into the inner portion of the room. The pair they sought were easy to spot among the tastefully dressed, mostly female clientele. Jason was a stringy youth with a long nose who wore a maroon hoodie and jeans and looked as though he might take flight at the slightest provocation. Staring down at his napkin, he resembled a scruffy heron. Tempest, whose black bob had certainly been dyed, and who wore thick, square, black-rimmed spectacles, was his physical opposite. Pale, dumpy and doughy, her small, deep-set eyes like raisins in a bun. Wearing a black T-shirt with a multicoloured cartoon pony stretched across an ample chest, she was sitting in a wheelchair adjacent to the table. Both had menus open in front of them. Tempest had already ordered herself a glass of wine. When she spotted Strike and Robin approaching, Tempest beamed, stretched out a stubby forefinger, and poked Jason on the shoulder. The boy looked around apprehensively. Strike registered the pronounced asymmetry of his pale blue eyes, one of which was a good centimetre higher than the other. It gave him an oddly vulnerable look, as though he had been finished in a hurry. "Hi," said Robin, smiling, and reaching out a hand to Jason first. "It's nice to meet you at last." "Hi," he muttered, proffering limp fingers. After one quick glance at Strike, he looked away, turning red.
"Well, hello," said Tempest, sticking out her own hand to Strike, still beaming.
Deftly, she reversed her wheelchair a few inches and suggested that he pull up a chair from a neighbouring table.
"This place is great. It's so easy to get around in, and the staff are really helpful. Excuse me," she said loudly to a passing waiter. "Could we have two more menus, please?"
Strike sat down beside her, while Jason shunted up to make room for Robin beside him.
"Lovely space, isn't it?" said Tempest, sipping her wine. "And the staff are wonderful about the wheelchair. Can't help you enough. I'm going to be recommending it on my site. I do a list of disability-friendly venues."
Jason drooped over his menu, apparently afraid to make eye contact with anyone. "I've told him not to mind what he orders," Tempest told Strike comfortably. "He didn't realize how much you'll have made from solving those cases. I've told him. The press will have paid you loads just for your story. I suppose that's what you do now. Try and solve the really high-profile ones." Strike thought of his plummeting bank balance, his glorified bedsit over the office, and the shattering effect the severed leg had had on his business.
"We try," he said, avoiding looking at Robin.
Robin chose the cheapest salad and a water. Tempest ordered a starter as well as a main course, urged Jason to imitate her, then collected in the menus to return them to the waiter with the air of a gracious hostess.
"So, Jason," Robin began.
Tempest at once talked over Robin, addressing Strike. "Jason's nervous. He hadn't really thought through what the repercussions of meeting you might be. I had to point them out to him. We've been on the phone day and night. You should see the bills."
"I should charge you!"
"But seriously." Her expression became suddenly grave. "We'd really like your assurance up front that we're not going to be in trouble for not telling the police everything. Because it wasn't as though we had any useful information. She was just a poor kid with problems. We don't know anything. We only met up with her once, and we haven't got a clue who killed her. I'm sure you know much more about it than we do. I was pretty worried when I heard Jason had been talking to your partner, to be honest, because I don't think anyone really appreciates how much we're persecuted as a community. I've had death threats myself. I should hire you to investigate them."
"Who's made death threats against you?" asked Robin in polite surprise.
"It's my website, you see," said Tempest, ignoring Robin and addressing Strike. "I run it. It's like I'm Den Mother, or Mother Superior. Anyway, I'm the one everyone confides in and comes to for advice, so obviously I'm the one who gets attacked when ignorant people target us. I suppose I don't help myself. I fight other people's battles a lot, don't I, Jason?"
"Anyway," she said,
pausing only to take a greedy sip of wine. I can't advise Jason to talk to you without a guarantee he's not going to get in any trouble. Strike wondered what possible authority she thought she had in the matter. The reality was that both Jason and Tempest had concealed information from the police, and whatever their reasons for doing so, and whether or not the information turned out to be valuable, their behaviour had been foolish and potentially harmful.
"I don't think either of you will be in trouble," he lied easily.
"Well, okay, that's good to hear," said Tempest with some complacency. "Because we do want to help, obviously. I mean, I said to Jason, if this man's preying on the BIID community, which is possible, I mean, bloody hell, it's our duty to help. It wouldn't surprise me either, the abuse we get on the website, the hatred. It's unbelievable. I mean, obviously it stems from ignorance, but we get abuse from people you'd expect to be on our side, who'd know exactly what it's like to be discriminated against." Drinks arrived. To Strike's horror, the Eastern European waiter upended his bottle of Spitfire beer into a glass containing ice.
"Hey," said Strike sharply.
"The beer isn't cold," said the waiter, surprised by what he clearly felt was Strike's overreaction.
"For fuck's sake," muttered Strike,
fishing the ice out of his glass. It was bad enough that he was facing a hefty lunch bill without ice in his beer. The waiter gave Tempest her second glass of wine with a slightly huffy air. Robin seized her chance. "Jason, when you first made contact with Kelsey..." But Tempest set down her glass and drowned Robin out. "Yeah, I checked all my records and Kelsey first visited the site back in December. Yeah, I told the police that. I let them see everything. She asked about you," Tempest told Strike, in a tone that suggested he ought to be flattered to have secured a mention on her website. "And then she got talking to Jason and they exchanged email addresses. And from then on they were in direct contact, weren't you, Jason?" "Yeah," he said weakly. "Then she suggested meeting up, and Jason got in touch with me, didn't you, Jason? And basically he thought he'd feel more comfortable if I came along, because after all, it's the internet, isn't it? You never know. She could have been anyone. She could have been a man." "What made you want to meet Kel?" Robin began to ask Jason, but again Tempest talked over her. "They were both interested in you, obviously," said Tempest to Strike. "Kelsey got Jason interested, didn't she, Jason? She knew all about you," said Tempest, smiling slyly, as though they shared disreputable secrets.
"So what did Kelsey tell you about me, Jason?" Strike asked the boy.
Jason turned scarlet at being addressed by Strike, and Robin wondered suddenly whether he could be gay. From her extensive perusal of the message boards, she had detected an erotic undertone to some, though not all, of the poster's fantasies, devotee being the most blatant of them. "She said," mumbled Jason, "a brother knew you, that he'd worked with you."
"Really?" said Strike. "Are you sure she said her brother?"
"Yeah."
"Because she didn't have one, only a sister."
Jason's lopsided eyes travelled nervously over the objects on the table before returning to Strike.
"I'm pretty sure she said brother."
"Worked with me in the army, did he?"
"No, not in the army, I don't think. Later."
She lied all the time. If it was Tuesday, she'd say it was Wednesday.
"Now, I thought she said her boyfriend told her," said Tempest. "She told us she had a boyfriend called Neil, Jason. Remember?"
"Niall,"
mumbled Jason. "Oh, was it? All right, Niall. He picked her up after we had coffee, remember?"
"Hang on," said Strike, raising a hand,
and Tempest paused obediently.
"You saw Niall?"
"Yes," said Tempest. "He picked her up on his motorbike." There was a brief silence.
"A man on a motorbike picked her up from... Where did you meet her?" asked Strike,
his calm tone belying his sudden pounding pulse. "Café Rouge on Tottenham Court Road," said Tempest.
That's not far from our office, said Robin. Jason turned an even darker red.
Oh, Kelsey and Jason knew that. You were hoping to see Corma and pop in, weren't you, Jason?
Laughed Tempest merrily as the waiter returned with her starter.
A man on a motorbike picked her up, Jason.
Tempest's mouth was full, and at last Jason was able to speak.
Yeah,
he said, with a furtive look at Strike.
He was waiting for her along the road. Could you see what he looked like?
Asked Strike, correctly anticipating the answer.
No, he was sort of tucked around the corner.
He kept his helmet on, said Tempest, washing down a mouthful with wine, the quicker to rejoin the conversation.
What colour was the motorbike, can you remember? Strike asked.
Tempest rather thought it had been black, and Jason was sure it had been red, but they agreed that it had been parked far too far away to recognise the make.
Can you remember anything else Kelsey said about her boyfriend? Asked Robin.
Both shook their heads.
Their main courses arrived midway through a lengthy explanation by Tempest of the advocacy and support services offered by the website she had developed. Only with her mouth full of chips did Jason finally find the courage to address Strike directly.
Is it true?
He said suddenly. His face again grew bright red as he said it.
Is what true? Asked Strike.
That you...
Chewing vigorously, Tempest leaned toward Strike in her wheelchair, placed her hand on his forearm, and swallowed.
That you did it yourself,
she whispered, with the ghost of a wink.
Her thick thighs had subtly readjusted themselves as she lifted them off the chair, bearing their own weight, instead of hanging behind the mobile torso.
Strike had been in Selly-Oak Hospital, with men left paraplegic and quadriplegic by the injuries they had sustained in war, seen their wasted legs, the compensations they had learned to make in the movement of their upper bodies to accommodate the dead weight below. For the first time, the reality of what Tempest was doing hit him forcibly. She did not need the wheelchair. She was entirely able-bodied. Strangely, it was Robin's expression that kept Strike calm and polite, because he found vicarious release in the look of distaste and fury she threw Tempest. He addressed Jason.
You'll need to tell me what you've been told before I can tell you whether it's true or not.
Well, said Jason, who had barely touched his black Angus burger. Kelsey said you went to the pub with a brother and you got drunk and told him the truth. She reckons you walked off your base in Afghanistan with a gun, and you went as far as you could in the dark, then you shot yourself in the leg, and then you got a doctor to amputate it for you.
Strike took a large swig of beer.
And I did this, why?
What? Said Jason, blinking confusedly.
Was I trying to get invalided out of the army, or...
Oh, no, said Jason, looking strangely hurt. No, you were...
He blushed so hard, it seemed unlikely that there was enough blood left in the rest of his body.
Like us. You needed it, he whispered. You needed to be an amputee.
Robin suddenly found that she could not look at Strike and pretended to be contemplating a curious painting of a hand holding a single shoe. At least she thought it showed a hand holding a shoe. It might equally have been a brown plant pot, with a pink cactus growing out of it.
The brother who told Kelsey all about me, did he know she wanted to take off her own leg?
I don't think so, no. She said I was the only one she'd ever told.
So you think it was just coincidence, he mentioned.
People keep it quiet, said Tempest, shoehorning herself back into the conversation at the first opportunity.
There's a lot of shame, a lot of shame. I'm not out at work, she said blithely, waving towards her legs. I have to say it's a back injury. If they knew I'm transabled, they'd never understand.
And don't get me started on the prejudice from the medical profession, which is absolutely unbelievable. I've changed GPs twice. I wasn't going to put up with being offered bloody psychiatric help again. No. Kelsey told her she'd never been able to tell anyone, poor little love. She had nobody to turn to. Nobody understood. That's why she reached out to us, and to you, of course, she told Strike, smiling with a little condescension because, unlike her, he had ignored Kelsey's appeal. You're not alone, mind. Once people have successfully achieved what they're after, they tend to leave the community. We get it. We understand. But it would mean a lot of people hung around just to describe what it feels like to finally be in the body you're meant to be in. Robin was worried that Strike might explode here in this polite white space where art lovers conversed in soft voices. However, she had reckoned without the self-control that the ex-Special Investigation Branch officer had learned through long years of interrogations. His polite smile to Tempest might have been a little grim, but he merely turned again to Jason and asked,
"So you don't think it was Kelsey's brother's idea for her to contact me?"
"No," said Jason. "I think that was all her own idea."
"So what exactly did she want from me?"
"Well, obviously," interposed Tempest, half laughing, "she wanted advice on how to do what you'd done."
"Is that what you think, Jason?" asked Strike.
And the boy nodded. "Yeah, she wanted to know how badly she'd have to injure her leg to get it taken off. And I think she had a sort of idea you'd introduce her to the doctor who did yours."
"That's the perennial problem," said Tempest, clearly oblivious to the effect she was having on Strike. "Finding reliable surgeons. They're usually completely unsympathetic. People have died trying to do it themselves. There was a wonderful surgeon in Scotland who performed a couple of amputations on BIID sufferers, but then they stopped him. That was a good 10 years ago. People go abroad, but if you can't pay, if you can't afford travel, you can see why Kelsey wanted to get her mitts on your contact list."
Robin let her knife and fork fall with a clatter, feeling on Strike's behalf all the offence that she assumed him to be experiencing. His contact list. As though his amputation was a rare artifact that Strike had bought on the black market. Strike questioned both Jason and Tempest for another 15 minutes before concluding that they knew nothing more of any use. The picture they painted of their one meeting with Kelsey was of an immature and desperate girl whose urge to be amputated was so powerful that she would, by the consent of both of her cyber friends, have done anything to achieve it.
"Yeah," sighed Tempest. "She was one of those. She'd already had a go when she was younger with some wire. We've had people so desperate they've put their legs on train tracks. One guy tried to freeze his leg off in liquid nitrogen. There was a girl in America who deliberately botched a ski jump. But the danger with that is you might not get exactly the degree of disability you're after."
"So what degree are you after?" Strike asked her.
He had just put his hand up for the bill.
"I want my spinal cord severed," said Tempest with total composure.
"Paraplegic, yeah. Ideally, I'll have it done by a surgeon. In the meantime, I'd just get on with it," she said, gesturing again to her wheelchair.
"Using the disabled bathrooms and stairlifts, the works, eh?" asked Strike.
"Cormoran," said Robin in a warning voice. She had thought this might happen. He was stressed and sleep-deprived. She supposed she ought to be glad that they had got all the information they needed first.
"It's a need," said Tempest composedly. "I've known ever since I was a child. I'm in the wrong body. I need to be paralyzed."
The waiter had arrived. Robin held out her hand for the bill, because Strike hadn't noticed him. "Quickly, please," she said to the waiter, who looked sullen. He was the man Strike had barked at for putting ice in his beer glass.
"Know many disabled people, do you?" Strike was asking Tempest.
"I know a couple," she said.
"Obviously, we've got a lot in..."
"You've got fuck all in common,"
Fuck all.
I knew it, muttered Robin under her breath, snatching the chip and pin machine out of the waiter's grip and shoving in her Visa card. Strike stood up